most of them wounded, who had somehow escaped. 6 more dead for the college as a result. As for Old Fort itself, barely a civilian was left alive after the treatment the posse had given them. Those of John's troops who were still left were indeed hardened now. Regarding Keller's prediction about another epidemic, he had been right. Days after the battle, what some were now calling the Plague Month began. There were nearly 3,000 new graves at the golf course, one of them for Doc Keller. The medical staff had been particularly hard hit. There were only 2 doctors and 1 vet remaining. It had indeed been like the plague in years of old, most physicians heroically standing to their duty until they were felled. But one had just fled, hiding in his cabin, and was now an outcast, the town pariah. The simple combination of disease and starvation had created a death rate as terrible as that of the Black Death of the 14th century. Added in were hundreds with hepatitis A, others carrying B and C, which would kick in later, the usual injuries, the minor cuts that led to amputation and death. It was the dying-off time, and by yesterday's count, just over 40% of the 2 communities which had been alive little more than 4 months back were still alive. As a war, it was the most horrific since the Middle Ages. The legendary 25 million dead in the Soviet Union during World War II had been but 1/7 its population. And yet now, briefly, they were swimming in food. The carefully guarded cornfields had yielded a bumper crop. Every apple orchard was stripped of its fruit, even the wormy ones. Pumpkins had fleshed out to 15-20 pounds or more, and would not just be used this year for carved decorations. The college scavengers were bringing in bushel baskets of nuts, pine cones, sunflowers, and in some places finding remains of orchards up in the woods where a homestead had been 100 years ago, the long-forgotten trees stripped clean. But the food had to be carefully counted, for it would need to last until the coming of spring, and what seemed like a bounty was in fact barely enough, actually not enough, for all to get through the winter. As for meat, there was now almost none. Still the occasional squirrel, rabbit, raccoon, or possum, but deer, bear, even wild boar had been hunted to near extinction. Yet again, the false memories of the supposed life on the frontier or up in the mountains now, that all one needed to do was get a gun, walk for a few hours, and then drag back 100 pounds or more of meat. But when thousands were thinking the same thing, in an area even as extensive as 500 square miles, and hunting season was now 365 days a year, the game was all but gone. Hunting parties from the college were going up into the high mountains for 3 and 4 days at a time, and more often than not coming back empty-handed. The forest had been hunted clean. So there was food, but there was no balance to the food. And the dying continued, even as apples were carefully hung to dry, corn stacked up in dry sheds, all covered by armed guards 24 hours a day. The few elderly in the community still alive were pressed into service to teach the now all but forgotten art of canning. The problem was there were hardly any proper canning jars and gaskets, which sealed them, to be found. Every day he had been terrified for Michaela, who was in the thick of it, but she had survived, untouched. She had avoided their house during the dying month, only coming down to check when John was finally hit by it and then Jen. Though, through luck or good nursing, the flu symptoms had run their course in a few days. Elizabeth had caught it as well, and John did not feel uncomfortable that, being pregnant, she was entitled to the now very rare antibiotics and additional rations to see her through. Fortunately, it had not touched Jennifer. But for her, the risk of flu was no longer the concern. It was Jennifer all were focused on now. The remaining insulin had finally lost all potency 2 weeks back, more than a month earlier than John had planned for. With the final bottle, Michaela risked several injections that finally totaled 800 units to bring Jennifer's blood sugar level back down from 520 to 145. It was now back over 600, climbing, and 6 days ago she had collapsed. All the symptoms that Keller had long warned John about were now full-blown. Extreme thirst at first, nearly uncontrollable urinating, a simple scuffed knee that had never really healed over, now raging with infection, red streaks up nearly to her groin, her fever soaring to 103. Her immune system had failed, kidneys were failing. Her precious little body was shutting down. He knew he should drive up to the Gap to check on the guard there, but that had to wait. The drive around town had fulfilled John's duty for the moment, though as he turned the corner past the ruins of the front porch, he could see, up the street, two bodies lying out along the curb, waiting to be picked up, and made a mental note to call Bartlett. John pulled into his usual slot in front of the town hall and got out, Michaela joining him. Judy was actually the person who was the center of the town as the switchboard operator, having risen from the quiet role of a secretary. She knew every call coming in and out, lived at the office, and at night monitored the battery-powered radio pulled out of the Blue Mustang, listening for news from the outside, which she would then post each morning on the whiteboard outside Town Hall. As he walked in, he could see the latest, a report that Asheville supposedly had a reliable two-way radio link with Charleston. Four emergency supply trucks had arrived in Greenville, South Carolina, and one was promised to Asheville by the end of the week. She had not posted the news, though, when she had called into him just after dawn that a helicopter had landed yesterday evening at Memorial Hospital, reportedly carrying a load of medicines. That knowledge would trigger an attempt by those still capable of moving to get into Asheville, and he knew that Asheville would not let any of them through the barrier near Exit 53 that was now a permanently fortified position, definitely payback for their defiance regarding the refugees back in the spring. The few refugees from outside trying to get farther west were allowed through, but anyone from Swannanoa or Black Mountain seeking to cross the line to barter was blocked. He walked into the office, Judy looking up from her switchboard.
"Hi, boss."
"Judy, connect me to Memorial Hospital. Put it through to my line and the line in the conference room."
"I'll get on it."
John went into his office, the office that had been Charlie's. John had not changed it all that much, the only addition a framed Polaroid picture of the survivors of what was now called the 1st Battalion Black Mountain Rangers. 81 soldiers standing in front of Gaither Hall, the picture taken a week after the battle. They looked 20 years older than the kids in another picture beside it, the annual graduation photo of all the seniors taken just 2 days before the day. Some were in both photos. The kids in the graduation photo looked fresh, ready to go out and take on the world with enthusiasm and joy. The Rangers, they looked as if they could take on the world by killing. The picture always made him think of a painting by Tom Lee, a combat artist of the Second World War, of a shell-shocked Marine at Peleliu, called the 2,000-yard stare.
"Boss, I got a line open. Pick up."
John lifted the rotary phone off the cradle, and there was a crackling hum.
"Memorial Hospital."
The voice sounded faint, distant.
"This is Black Mountain calling," Judy said. "Can you connect a call to the hospital director, Dr. Vance, from Dr. Matheson, director of public safety in Black Mountain?"
Michaela had advised Judy to use John's old title. Doctors of the M.D. kind looked down on doctors of the Ph.D. kind, but still it would help to get through.
"Please hold,"
came the voice from the other end. John looked across at Michaela, who was standing at the crank phone in the conference room. 5 minutes passed, then 10. He sat on his desk, waiting nervously, heart racing, the only sound static. And then a distant voice.
"Vance here."
Dr. Vance, this is... He hesitated. Matheson, Director of Public Safety for Black Mountain.
What do you want?
He could hear the exhaustion in Vance's voice. John looked over at Michaela and nodded. He was afraid if he continued, emotion would take over, and the man on the other end had no time for emotional appeals. John had sat in the same spot now since Charlie's death. Decisions about who got rations and who did not, the condemning to death by execution of 22 people for looting of food. In one night, 15 of them had killed off 2 head of cattle. And, horrifyingly, 1 for cannibalism. Fortunately, he was now able to delegate that terrible deed to someone else. 3 people, 1 from Swannanoa, 1 from Black Mountain, and a professor from the college. John had listened to so many appeals, and always he had to judge based upon what was fair. And fairness was who might be able to make it through to next spring, and who was now triaged off.
Dr. Vance, this is Michaela Turner. I was head RN with the cardiac surgical unit at Overlook in Charlotte. I work directly with Dr. Billings. I'm now head of all emergency treatment here in Black Mountain.
That line was carefully prepared by her to create a sense of equality and draw from the tradition of mutual professional respect.
Billings, how is he?
And then a pause, a realization most likely of the absurdity of the question.
Doctor? On the day things went down, I was coming up to Memorial to attend your briefing on the new cauterization method for control of PAT arrhythmia.
A pause.
Seems like a million years ago.
And John could hear the voice on the other side soften. Michaela had thought this out well. He looked over to her, but her back was turned to him, avoiding eye contact.
Nurse Michaela.
Turner, she said. Dr. Vance, we have a situation here I think you can address.
Go on.
And John could hear the tension come back into Vance's voice.
We got word that a helicopter load of medical supplies was airlifted to your hospital last night.
A long pause.
Yes, that is correct.
Dr. Vance, we have a girl, 12 years old. Type 1 diabetic.
And she's still alive?
There was an incredulous note in his voice.
She's been carefully monitored and is a tough kid. Her father was able to obtain enough insulin to last 5 months, but the stock has degraded and all potency is gone.
Amazing she lasted this long.
John stiffened, again looking at Michaela the way she was now so clinically talking about Jennifer.
Dr. Vance, was any insulin included in that shipment?
There was a pause.
Was there any insulin? John asked, cutting back in, his voice tense.
Yes. A pause on the other end.
How long has she been without insulin?
Vance asked. Michaela quickly turned, looked at John, and shook her head.
Last injection 4 days ago.
It was a lie. It had been over 2 weeks. Silence on the other end.
Blood count?
310.
Again a lie. It was over twice that now and still climbing.
Dr. Vance?
Michaela asked.
Yes?
We can send a vehicle to pick up the vial, just 1,000 units. It will save her life.
He sighed. And with that sigh, John knew. How many had heard him sigh in the same way before rejecting their tearful appeal for but one more bowl of soup, or the release of but 2 or 3 pills of Cipro, or the few precious Z-Pak antibiotics locked away in a safe?
"Save her life for how long?" Vance finally replied.
"A month?
The insulin received might be all we'll get for several months. It's already been designated for those who can survive on far lower doses than type 1 diabetics need.
Dr. Vance, we can have her at the hospital in an hour, just 1 injection to stabilize her. We've heard the road might be open down to Columbia and from there to Charleston. We'll risk driving her down there if you can help us stabilize her.
You and I both know the road is not open. A dozen people from here tried to get through just to Greenville yesterday and were wiped out by raiders in Saluda Gap, Vance replied.
And even if you did get through, there's no chance she'll be given more. The authorities in Charleston have listed insulin along with a couple hundred other drugs as a priority, meaning to be distributed in extreme need only to those under the age of 45 and over 18 with high probability of survival and the ability to work in some manner. They sent me exactly 5 vials.
Frustrated, John thought of Don Barber's plane. Is there a means to fly her out? John interjected forcefully. Surely you must have planes down at Asheville Airport that are still flying.
We did, but we don't now. We lost the last 2 a week ago.
The pilots just took off with their families and disappeared. And even if we did have that means, I'd prioritize 100 other cases first for airlift, even if we had it.
Michaela waved for John to shut up, and there was a long pause.
A long pause that drifted into nearly a minute of silence.
I'm sorry, but the answer is no.
Now, if you'll excuse me, John stood up.
We are talking about my daughter, he shouted.
I suspected that, Vance replied, and suspect as well that it's been far longer than 4 days since her last injection.
Please, Dr. Vance, please, it's my daughter, just 1 injection.
John, isn't it?
Yes.
John, like I said, they sent up 5 vials. I've got 2 kids in this hospital now who have standard childhood diabetes and are barely hanging on, but God forgive me, I'm withholding the medicine even from them, because I've got nearly 30 adults with varying degrees of diabetes that can survive a lot longer with just a low dose. I might need this stock for the rest of the year to try and save some that can be saved.
Please, for God's sake,
John, please listen. 1 injection for your daughter will not change the final diagnosis. It will simply postpone the inevitable.
My God, he said wearily, do you think I want to tell you this?
John, I have enough anesthesia for maybe 20 operations, and we need hundreds, painkillers, even just some damn aspirin.
His voice trailed off. Michaela was waving John off, signaling him to be quiet.
Dr. Vance, Michaela here. I've been treating this girl since all this started. She's a tough kid, a survivor. We can save her life.
For how long? Vance replied, and now his voice was getting cold.
Type 1 diabetics. 100 years ago, they died within weeks after pancreatic shutdown. That's the world we are back in now, maybe for years to come.
Again a pause.
Nurse Turner, you understand triage as well as I do.
Triage? John shouted. You are talking about my daughter, goddammit! You will not triage her off!
Sir, I am sorry for you. I truly am.
Damn you! Listen to me. I can mobilize 100 well-trained infantry, and by God, we will be there in an hour, and by God, you will give me that insulin, and if need be, I'll blow up the water main to your damn town.
A long silence.
Are you listening to yourself? Vance said. Would you really do that?
Yes!
I don't think so, John. I've heard a lot about you, John. You are not the type to get innocent people killed if you try that stunt. And if you do, the Asheville militia will meet you at exit 53, and this hospital is cordoned with troops as well. If you blow the main, thousands of innocent people will suffer. I'm sorry for you, sir.
God save us, I'm sorry for all of us. Sorry for those who could have prevented this and now must carry that on their souls.
His voice trailed off, breaking into a muffled sob.
Goodbye.
The line clicked off.
No!
John swung the phone around, tearing the wire connection out. Filled with impotent rage, he held the phone and then flung it against the wall.
"John, please."
Michaela was in the room, tears streaming down her face.
"Damn all of this! Damn this country! Damn all of this!"
And he collapsed into his chair, sobbing.
"Come on, John. Let's go home. She needs us there."
He finally stood up. In the hallway, Judy was standing by the switchboard. She had heard every word and was silently weeping. Tom, gaunt, face pale, was silent, standing in the hallway beside Judy, looking at him.
"John, I'm willing to go up there and try and get it for you," Tom said softly.
Michaela shook her head.
"No, Tom, we're going home. Can you see to things the next few days?"
"Sure."
"Judy, hold any calls to the house?"
Michaela drove John home. As they passed through the guard post, manned as always by two students, John said nothing. Acknowledging nothing, the students watching him, eyes wide, as he and Michaela drove through, for they could see he was crying. Jen was outside the house as they pulled up, Michaela helping John to get out. She didn't need to be told.
"How is she?" Michaela asked. "Drifting in and out. Breath is fruity-smelling like you said it would be. She's no longer urinating. I can't get water into her." "John?"
It was Michaela, hands grasping him tight.
"You have to do this now. I want you to go in there as if everything is fine. She is not to know you are afraid. If she asks about medicine, tell her it's coming shortly. She cannot know you are afraid." He nodded. "You ready?"
"Yes."
He walked up the front steps and opened the door, then paused.
"Hail Mary, full of grace," he started to whisper,
the prayer going silent as he stepped into the house. The alcove that faced towards the creek had been converted into the sick room, a bed set up, raised up higher with books underneath so Jennifer could see out the window, watch the creek and the bird feeder. Elizabeth had finally stirred out of her shock as this crisis came, and had spent several hours cracking pine cones, gathering handfuls of the precious seeds to fill the feeder, and keeping by Jennifer's bedside, reading to her. Ginger, now nothing but skin and bones, barely able to walk, had crawled up onto the foot of the bed. Jennifer turned and looked towards him.
"Daddy?"
"Here, my pumpkin."
He came over and sat by the bed. She was clutching Rabs tight, and arrayed on the far side of the bed were the three beanie babies she had snatched as they evacuated the now lost home, one of them Patriot Bear, the gift for her 12th birthday.
"Will I get well?"
"Sure, sweetheart. You'll be up and running in no time. Michaela and I ordered some medicine, and it will be here soon."
He was afraid to look up at Michaela, who he knew was standing in the doorway. If they made eye contact, he feared he'd break. Jennifer turned away, features pale.
"You're lying, Daddy. You never could lie to me."
"No, honey, it's the truth. You'll soon feel well." She said nothing, just looking at him. "Sweetie, would you like me to read to you?"
Head turned away. She nodded. He stood up, scanning the bookshelf, and saw two books, and his heart filled. Both had obviously belonged to Mary, one from early childhood. He opened them. Inside one was inscribed, "Merry Christmas, Sweetheart, 1976. The second had, in a childish scrawl in pink crayon, "My book, Mary." He set the second book to one side, returned to Jennifer's bed, opened the first, and started to read. "When Mr. Bilbo Baggins of Bag End..." And then he stopped. No, not this one. She had seen the movies when they had first come out, and was young enough then that it had frightened her. He put The Lord of the Rings aside and picked up the second book. It had been Mary's favorite as a child,
and it was why Rabs, now nestled in Jennifer's arms, was named Rabs. On the day Jennifer was born, he had placed Rabs in her crib, and Mary had cried at the sight of the snowy white rabbit from a story she had loved in her own childhood days. Rabs, now so dingy gray from years of being held, kissed, and loved, was nestled in Jennifer's arms. "The Adventures of Rabs the Rabbit," he began, swallowing hard as he turned the first page, remembering so many nights when Mary would read Jennifer to sleep with this wonderful old classic that mother and daughter had so loved and cherished together. One day, when Jennifer and her best friend Rabs had nothing else to do. The real name in the book was Kathy, but Mary had always used Jennifer's name, the same way when she was a child her mother had used hers. He looked up at Jen, who stood silent by the foot of the bed, who, unable to speak, could merely nod her head. He felt such love and pity for her at this moment, for all that she had lost as well. And he began to read. The house was silent throughout the day, except for John softly reading, pausing when Jennifer was obviously asleep. The shadows lengthened. The windows still open, the cool air drifting in, but he did not close them, the soft rushing of the brook outside the window soothing with its gentle murmur. Jennifer stirred, Michaela trying to get her to drink. She wouldn't, so Michaela just sat by the other side of the bed, moistening Jennifer's lips with a damp towel.
"Daddy?"
She looked up at him, eyes open. "Sweetie?"
"Remember your promise?"
"Which one was that, Angel?"
"Let me stay close to you, and keep Rabs warm and with you. He loves you, too."
"Of course. Of course." And control did finally break. Crying, John leaned over and hugged her, kissing her forehead. She tried to put her arms around him, but couldn't. And as he took her hands, he could feel how cold they were. He tucked Rabs back under her arms, floppy head of the much-loved stuffed rabbit resting on her chest. Michaela sat on the other side of the bed, gently brushing Jennifer's brow. Elizabeth had led Jen away, the two in the next room, sobbing. Jennifer was no longer sweat-soaked, and he knew what that meant. Michaela slowly let her hand drift to Jennifer's throat, felt the pulse, and looked over at John. He picked the book back up. It was nearly finished. And he continued to read, turning the page with one hand, holding Jennifer's hand with the other. He could feel her hand getting colder, and he read now, almost in a fast monotone, turning the pages, and then reached the last one. And so Rabs, nestled in Jennifer's arms, watched as she went to sleep. "Some day you will be all grown up," Rabs whispered to her, "but I will love you forever. And far, far away we will play again some day. Sleep tight, Jennifer, and I will see you in the morning."
"John?"
Michaela whispered. He couldn't speak.
"John, she's gone."
He knew. He had felt her slip away before he had turned the last page. She was buried in the garden, her grave near the bay window, very close by to him, as promised. At nighttime, Rabs rested on the windowsill inside the house, keeping vigilant watch. He had spent a fair part of the day outside, just sitting by her grave, holding Rabs, talking to Jennifer as if she were sitting before him, again his little girl of five, the fur on Rabs still not completely worn off as it now was, Ginger barely able to move, lying by his side. It was towards evening, and Michaela came to sit by him.
"I'm worried about Elizabeth," she said. "She needs to eat."
"There's nothing to eat," John replied, "other than the rations at the college."
"John?"
She's in her third month. It's crucial now, perhaps the most crucial month of all. The rations are mostly carbs. She needs protein, meat, as much as we can force into her.
Michaela fell silent, leaning against his shoulder, and he knew what she was saying. It was not a hard decision at all now. Not hard at all. He went into the house and came out a minute later carrying the .22 pistol. He handed Rabs to her. Ginger was lying by Jennifer's grave, as if keeping watch. He knelt down and picked Ginger up. She was so light. "Come along," he whispered. "You can still save a life, my dear friend. And besides, Jennifer wants to play with you again."
How doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? How is she become as a widow? She that was great among the nations and princess among the provinces, how is she become tributary?
Book of Lamentations, Chapter 1, Verse 1. Chapter 12. Day 365. The phone ringing by his bedside woke him up, the light streaming through the window. It was just about dawn. He could hear crying in the next room, little Ben, Elizabeth shushing him. John picked up the phone. It was Judy, and he listened, finally sitting up. "I'll be down there as quickly as possible." Michaela was snuggled up by his side, half awake. "Come on, love, get up now."
"What?"
She opened her eyes and looked around.
"Not even dawn yet."
"Up. We gotta get into town, all of us." He pulled on the old stiff trousers lying by the side of the bed and rubbed his chin, suddenly wondering if he should shave. Absurd. He had not shaved in more than 6 months. It had been warm enough a week ago for all of them to have a bath. He had built a roaring fire, scooped water from the creek to heat, and then filled what had once been a small outdoor fish pond. By the time the girls and the baby had finished, the water was a dark, scummy gray, but John didn't care. The first, at least, tepid bath since late autumn. The following day, Michaela and Jen had scrubbed clothes along the bank of the creek the old-fashioned way, a flat rock and an antique scrub board scrounged out of the basement. All had walked up to the college that evening for an actual spring dinner feast. 140 of the surviving students, Reverend Abel offering a service in the chapel of the prodigal, the choir putting on a musical performance, and then what was supposed to be a one-act comedy about someone finding a television that still worked. It had fallen rather flat, too painful, though the audience did laugh politely. Ben had, of course, been passed from girl to girl, and for more than a few it was practice. The autumn and winter had resulted in more than a few pregnancies and rather quick marriages by Reverend Abel. The dinner, of boiled corn mixed with apples, garnished with ramps and the first dandelions of spring, had at least been filling. After the dinner, music, and play, he had met with Abel, Malady, and the surviving faculty to talk about trying to get at least a few courses up and running. But the conversation had fallen away. It was time to struggle to bring in the first greens, to get hunting parties out, to maybe, just maybe, get the turbine project finished at the dam and finally hook electricity back up. Courses could wait until the fall. He walked out into the living room, Elizabeth standing by the window watching the sunrise, Ben nuzzled against her, nursing. She did so look like her mother as she looked over her shoulder and smiled at him contentedly. That Madonna-like face all new mothers have when nursing a child.
"Morning, Daddy."
"How is he this morning?"
"Hungry, little devil."
"Get something on a little more presentable than that old bathrobe. You're going into town with me now."
"Why?"
"Just do it. Wake up Jen and tell her to get moving as well." He walked outside. The air was chilled, the sky overhead clear. The trees were really leafing out now, though farther up the slope of the mountains it was still winter, and Mitchell was still snow-capped. Strange. A year ago today. Precisely a year ago.
He walked round the side of the house and saw a fresh tulip beginning to blossom. He snapped it off and placed it on Jennifer's grave.
"Good morning, my little angel," he whispered, and looked back to the window where Rab sat gazing down protectively. Next to her grave was another, smaller. Very little had been buried there, but he felt he owed Ginger that for her sacrifice. Elizabeth had found a faded ceramic dog and placed it there for Ginger shortly after Ben was born.
"Dad, what is it?"
Elizabeth was outside holding Ben. "Just get in the car." The old Edsel, the miracle machine, was still running, though just barely, the rings going. He turned it over and it revved to life, black exhaust blowing out. Their remaining stock of gas was increasingly contaminated. Jen came out, helped by Michaela. The two had indeed bonded over the long winter. The starving winter, it was now called by those who had survived it. Jen was failing. Though she stood proudly straight a year ago, osteoporosis was taking over. She was developing cataracts also, but could still see well enough to at least read, which had become her source of comfort during the long, cold winter months spent next to the fireplace. The firewood. Though he argued against it, students made sure the house was supplied, and provided extra rations for Elizabeth as well. Jen got into the back, alongside Elizabeth, and Michaela climbed into the front seat. He backed out and started towards town.
"What the hell is it?"
Jen asked a bit peevishly. "Did someone get a bear?" That had happened 3 weeks ago, and had been the cause of an actual celebration in town. Bear stew, enough to feed 1,000 when some of the precious dried corn and apples were mixed in. 1,000, 960 actually, was the number now, at least as of yesterday afternoon. The starving winter, as Keller predicted, had taken down most of the rest of the survivors. The months of cold, increasing solitude as already weakened neighbors died away. Fires going out, the weak far too weak to crawl out, bring in wood, and relight the flame, curling up and then just going to sleep. The death rate soared once more. Just yesterday at the town council meeting, Michaela, now head of public health, had raised the terrible issue of burials. It had broken down by February. There were too many dead and too few left with the strength to bury them. It was estimated that hundreds of homes might now actually be morgues, the entire family dead. 100 or more bodies were lying in the graveyard, decaying. The decision was made to burn them, the grisly task to be seen to by those who would accept triple rations as payment. That now was a horrible irony as well. With so many dying during the long winter, there was now actually enough food to see the rest through to summer. John drove down Black Mountain Road, the road that had been his daily commute for so many years. There was no longer a guard at the gate, too few left to man it, along with the outposts and barricades. At the intersection to Flat Creek Road, he had to take a turnoff. The ice storm of 2 months ago had dropped dozens of trees in the town, the next block still impassable. There was no one with the strength to clear the trees. The 1st Battalion did still have strength, but he had kept them strictly to other tasks, to be the army, guarding the passes throughout the winter and guarding the food supplies. Their survival rate had been just about the highest. Black Mountain had lost close to 80% of its population in exactly 1 year, the college just over 60%, including the casualties from the war. Part of it was the resilience of kids in their late teens to early 20s, part of it the strict discipline, created by Washington Parker, continued now by Kevin Malady, and the slow, heroic sacrifice of President Hunt and his wife, who died from starvation a month after the battle, so that our kids could have another meal. That memory had stayed with them, bonded them, inspired them. And as for the bonding, the campus chaplain had to perform 8 weddings, and a couple of the girls were coming close to due, and, like Elizabeth, 2 of them would be mothers who lost the fathers in the war.
Cutting around the fallen trees, John pulled back onto Black Mountain Road, continuing in towards town. A number of houses had burned during the winter and were gutted out shells, others just abandoned, all within dead. The few with life still inside had yards already planted with this spring's victory gardens. There wasn't a lawn to be seen. The town was quiet, more a ghost town now, but still had some survivors, and many of them were heading down to the center of town, some of them nearly running. They all looked like survivors of a death camp, skeletal, children lanky with swollen stomachs, nearly every man bearded, nearly all in clothes several sizes too big. John drove faster now, heading down the center of the road, the sides filled with debris, broken branches from the storms, cars abandoned since the first day. And as he came around the bend to the center of town, he saw them. And at the sight of them, Elizabeth, Jen, and Michaela all let out a shriek, screaming so loudly that Ben burst into tears. John pulled into the town hall complex, not even bothering to find his parking slot. Hundreds were gathering, some even running. He got out of the car and looked at them. A Bradley armored personnel carrier was at the front of the column, fluttering from a pole strapped to its side, the flag of the United States of America. Behind the Bradley was a column that stretched back down the road for several hundred yards, Humvees, a couple of dozen trucks, 5 18-wheelers, another Bradley, most all of them painted desert camo, all of them flying American flags. "Here he is!" someone shouted, pointing towards John. The cry was picked up, the people of his town parting as he slowly approached, eyes clouded with tears as he gazed up at the flag. An officer was standing in front of the lead vehicle, surrounded by nearly a dozen of his own troops who should be back at the Gap, the 1st Battalion of the Black Mountain Rangers, talking with soldiers decked out as soldiers as John remembered them, Kevlar helmets, a mix of uniforms, though, some desert camo, some standard camo green, a few in urban camo. And yet it was his kids, his soldiers, who looked to be the tougher of the two groups. Lean, hawk-faced, eyes dark and hollow, weapons slung casually, the regular infantry obviously a bit in awe of them, especially the girls, who seemed as tough as the guys they were with. Nation-makers, he thought. He could see it now. His former students, like the soldiers in the Howard Pyle painting, ragged, half-starved, and yet filled with grim determination unlike anything seen in America in over 200 years. The lead officer next to the Bradley, John could see the star clipped to his lapels, was actually in his dress uniform, as if to distinguish him, to make him stand out clearly.
"Here's Colonel Matheson!"
And at his approach, the soldiers of his own militia came to attention and presented arms. And to his shock, the GIs standing around them, with all sincerity, came to attention and saluted. The crowd surrounding them fell silent. John slowed, stopped, looking at the one-star general, came to attention, and saluted. "Colonel John Matheson," he said. The general returned the salute, broke into a grin, and came forward, hand extended, grabbing John's, shaking it. "I know you, Matheson. Attended your lectures at Carlisle and did the staff ride with you to Gettysburg. Your lecture on Lee as operational commander at 2nd Manassas was brilliant. That was back in the 90s. A wild cheer went up, as if this simple handshake was the reuniting with the old world. The crowd surged around them, soldiers suddenly finding themselves being kissed, hugged, more than one of them obviously disconcerted, since many of those showering affection had not bathed in months, and more than a few were crawling with lice. John smiled, looked at the general, the face vaguely familiar, but could not place the name, finally looking down at the nameplate. Wright. John wondered what Wright was seeing. Americans? Or starved skeletal survivors, the type of survivors that America had seen all around the world for nearly 70 years, had offered generous help to, but never dreamed would finally come to their own land. "This column is heading to Asheville.
I'm to take over as military governor of Western North Carolina until such time as civilian authority is reestablished, but I wanted to stop here first. The cheering crowd did not hear him, but John did. You're not staying? Headquarters will be in Asheville, but yes, we are staying in the region. A sergeant standing atop the Bradley held up a microphone and clicked it. May I have your attention, please? Everyone fell silent, looking up at him with awe. It was the first voice amplified by a loudspeaker that they had heard in a year. Excuse me, Wright said, and he climbed aboard the Bradley, the sergeant extending a hand to pull him up. My name is General Wright. I am an officer in the Army of the United States of America, and we are here to reunite you with your country. The cheering lasted for several minutes. Michaela was up by John's side, hugging him. Many were crying. And then spontaneously, one of the militia girls, a member of the school choir, began to sing, Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? Within seconds, it was picked up by all, and all wept, even as they sang. The general stood with head lowered, and there was no acting as he brushed the tears from his face. I have been assigned to be military governor of the region of Western North Carolina. My headquarters will be established by the end of the day. You're not leaving us? Someone cried. No, of course not. I'm asking you now to move to the rear of this column and please line up patiently. Each of you will then receive 3 rations, what the Army calls meals ready to eat. Another wild cheer. We have a medical team with us, who will try and lend a hand with any serious cases of the moment. All children, expectant mothers, and mothers of infants will also receive a 3-month supply of vitamins. Vitamins, John thought. My God, so American. Something good from a small bottle. It lifted him even more than the food. Elizabeth had come through her time, but just barely. The vitamins for her and the baby would be lifesavers. This column must depart in 1 hour for Asheville, but I swear to you, as a soldier of the United States of America, we are here to stay. By next week, another supply column with more food and medicine should arrive. He handed the microphone back to the sergeant and jumped down, returning to John, while the sergeant started to direct the crowd to move, the troops with him helping. John watched them go. A medic already up to Elizabeth, stopping her, looking at her and the baby. The mere sight of that again filled John with tears. Soldiers were already passing out single sticks of chewing gum to children, who, upon learning about the treats, were swarming round. As the crowd flooded past, the general motioned for John to walk with him. How bad was it here? Very bad, John said. Yeah. I saw your greeting card at the top of the pass. John suddenly felt embarrassed. The corpse of the posse leader had hung there throughout the winter, bones picked clean in a matter of days by crows. Part of the skeleton still dangled there. The ravine below had been a feasting place for scavengers for weeks, nearly 1,000 bodies dumped there. We followed the wreckage of their trail clear from Statesville to here. You did a hell of a job wiping them out. I saw the ashes of the fire on both sides of the interstate. It burned clear down to Old Fort, or what was Old Fort. You did that to trap them. John nodded. Good plan, Colonel. History teaches something at times. How many survivors here? One of the first things we'll need done is an accurate census. Then ration cards will be issued out. I already have cards issued. Wright smiled. These will be for federal rations. Right. And John nodded, wondering if he was suddenly feeling a resentment that he had just lost control, after so many painful months of struggling to keep his town alive. What percentage survived here?
Around 20%, maybe a bit less if we count those who came in after it happened.
Wright shook his head. Is that bad? John asked nervously, wondering now if he had failed. Bad? Christ, it's incredible up here. Places like the Midwest with lots of farmland and low populations, more than half survived, but the East Coast?
he sighed. Here in the east, it's a desert now. Estimates are maybe less than 10% still alive. They hit us at the worst possible time, early spring. Food would run out before local harvests came in, and a lot of crops, especially farther north, had yet to be put in the ground. He looked off. They say in all of New York City there's not much more than 25,000 people now, and those are either savages or people hiding and living off scraps of garbage. A thermonuclear bomb hitting it directly would have been more humane. Cholera actually broke out there last fall, and the government decided to abandon the city just to isolate it, and no one was allowed in. The few in were not allowed out. A friend of mine stationed there on duty said it was like the Dark Ages. He sighed and forced a smile, as if realizing he was rambling, talking about something best left unsaid. You did good, Colonel Matherson, real good. We ran into a few refugees on the road, bitter that you wouldn't let them in, but one old guy, a vet, said he admired you folks. That word was you actually stuck together while the rest of the country went to hell. He nodded, unable to speak. Wright stood silent, then lowered his head, his voice a whisper. They say nearly everyone in Florida is dead. Too many people, too little land devoted to food. What about all the oranges and cattle land? Everything broke down. People killed the cattle for a single meal, and in that heat, by the following morning, most of the meat was rotting and swarming with flies. So they ate it anyhow. And you know what then happened? The ocean? All the food out there? Incredible as it sounds, pirates made it all but impossible for any kind of serious fishing. It was like something out of the 17th century. The coast is riddled now with pirates. The Navy is hunting them down. A couple of small towns, especially along the Keys, set up good defenses, only one road to block, and their own navies to guard the fishing boats, so they got through relatively okay. But the hurricane last fall knocked them over pretty hard. Hurricane? He had all but forgotten that natural catastrophes that had once riveted the nation and caused massive outpourings of aid would still continue, and, if striking but 100 miles away, be all but unheard of. Another Katrina, bullseye right on Miami, a smaller one Tampa St. Pete a few months later. He fell silent for a moment, looking off. This time around, though, no outside help to come pouring in like in New Orleans. It was a death blow for those still alive. Add in the heat without A.C., few houses down there today were designed for living without A.C. Add in 20% of the population as elderly, so many dying in the first days that they say that in some of the retirement towns, the dead carpeted the streets, again, like something out of the plagues of old. Disease just exploded in that climate. That's what killed most of them before starvation even set in. Food poisoning, heat exhaustion, bad water or no water, then malaria, West Nile. They say typhoid and dysentery ran rampant in the Miami area, even reports of bubonic plague. He paused. Cannibalism, even, like your posse types. But also a lot of people driven mad with hunger. Cults sprang up, one damn near like the Aztecs, into human sacrifices to atone for the wrath of the earth spirits. Others, some weird play on the Last Supper and communion, that this was now God's will, and it was okay to eat the dead. Others, well, just wackos. John sighed. The Prozac nation on withdrawal, he thought, remembering Keller's warning. The only ones left there now, the barbarians, and a few small communities with good tactical positions like yours, and a good leader like you. There was something about the way the general spoke that caught John. Why was he focusing on Florida? John looked at him, felt he shouldn't, but had to ask. Sir, your family, are they okay? The general looked back at him, eyes bright. I was with Central Asian Command. You know our stateside command is in Tampa, St. Pete. I shipped over to Iraq a month before we got hit. He sighed. Wife, three kids, daughter-in-law, and two grandkids lived in St. Pete. I haven't heard a word since it happened. I'm sorry, sir. Yeah, we are all sorry now. John could not speak. Voice of America never said anything about that. The general shook his head. Did you think we'd actually tell you the truth? He sighed. John bristled. So what the hell is the truth? We had our asses handed to us. That's the truth. Just several bombs, and we had our asses handed to us. With luck, there might be 30 million people still alive in what was the United States. What do you mean, was? The general shook his head. Course you wouldn't know. We're not talking about it on Voice of America. You can write off the Southwest, including Texas, unless we can dig up another Sam Houston and Davy Crockett. During the winter, Mexico moved in, claimed it was a protectorate to counter the Chinese. What? China? Oh, they came with aid, plenty of aid, for the few survivors after 60 days of anarchy and disease. And now there's 500,000 of them on the West Coast, California to Washington State, clear up to the Rockies. Who? Chinese troops. Here to help us, of course, Wright said, his voice bitter. Oh, they're giving out aid, even helping with some rebuilding. But there's no sign they ever planned to leave. So it was them? The general shrugged. We'll never know, most likely. What? John, 3 missiles total. One launched from a container ship out in the Gulf of Mexico and burst over Kansas, Utah, and Ohio. The cargo ship, typical, had Liberian registry and had docked at half a dozen places, including Oman. We think the weapons might have been loaded aboard there, a medium-range missile capped with a nuke inside an oversized container. That ship, by the way, blew up right after the launch. No one survived, so it fits the terrorist model. Another over Russia, launched from another container ship from near Iceland. Same scenario. The ship blew up right after the launch. We don't know why over Russia rather than over Central Europe. Maybe its guidance was screwy. But that did mean England and parts of Spain were spared. Last one burst lower, but still high enough to knock out Japan and Korea. Some say it was China, others North Korea, which, by the way, is now a glowing slag heap, others the terrorist cells, others Iran, a fair part of that glowing as well. Maybe it was all of them. Maybe it was none of them. Maybe it doesn't matter now. They did it, and they won. What do you mean, won? Damn it, Voice of America kept saying we were winning. Sure, there's a lot of rubble heaps around the world where once there were cities, us lashing out, maybe rightly, maybe just blindly. But did that change things here? I was deployed back here from Iraq. The entire Navy is here as well, on the East Coast at least. Nearly all our overseas military is now back here trying to sort things out, rebuild, and defend what's left. John, I saw Baltimore and Washington burning in the night, the smoke a pillar visible 100 miles away. And he spoke now in almost a monotone. My God, it was like something out of the Bible. It was medieval. Washington. And for the first time in months, John thought of Bob Scales at the Pentagon. Remember General Scales, commandant of the War College while you were there? Wright nodded his head. The bastards lucky enough to be assigned the government emergency relocation sites. Some of them got out, the rest... Well, Washington, like I said, turned medieval. I don't know what happened to your friend. I'm sorry, but he's most likely gone,
unless he was assigned to the bunkers out in Maryland and West Virginia. Wright looked off again. There's a cult that has taken over parts of three states in the Rockies. Their leader claims he's the Messiah, and when the world